I've been a moviegoer for most of my life. And of all the movies I've seen, I still have very little trouble identifying the single most frightening scene in any one of them. It's nothing that Stephen King or any other master of horror could have ever come up with. Rather, it's in the movie Cabaret. This movie came out about 35 years ago now. The lead, as those of you who've seen it recall or may remember, was as the nightclub singer and performer Sally Bowles, was played by a then very cute and thin Liza Minnelli. I shouldn't talk. I was thin myself once, and I was never cute. But, anyway, Ms. Bowles, Liza Minnelli, Sally Bowles, sings and performs at a rather decadent nightclub in Berlin called the Kit Kat Club. The year is 1930, during the days of the Weimar Republic in Germany. World War II is still a little ways out on the horizon. The scene I'm recalling, though, takes place away from Berlin, out in a beautiful countryside spot. Two of the film's male characters who share the, affections of Minnelli's Sally Bowles are out for a drive. They stop for a drink at a roadside tavern. And the setting is about as bucolic as the movie makers could have made it. There are green rolling hills, bathed in sunshine, a deep blue sky, pleasant conversation going on amongst the eaters and the drinkers. And then above the chatter, a very sweet melodic voice breaks into song. And the camera comes in very tight on the angelic face of a young man who stands and sings these pastoral lyrics. The sun in the meadow is shimmering gold. The stag in the forest runs free. So gather together to greet the sun. Tomorrow belongs to me. At first, it sounds like something you would have heard sung around a campfire, maybe at a youth gathering of some sort. The camera pans back a little bit to where you can see a light brown collar on the young man's shirt and some kind of a kerchief around his neck. And his song continues, the branch of the linden is leafy and green. The Rhine makes its way to the sea. And somewhere a glory awaits unseen. Tomorrow belongs to me. Some of the younger people who are there now stand and begin to start singing along with the young man. And his melodic and angelic voice takes on just an edge of defiance. The babe in the cradle is closing his eyes. The blossom embraces the bee. But soon there's a whisper, arise, arise, tomorrow belongs to me. By now, many of those in the beautiful garden tavern are rising to their feet. Some of them are hoisting their drinks. The camera is back far enough now to allow you to see a swastika emblem on the young man's shirt sleeve, as well as on the sleeves of several others. And the last verse of this innocently sweet song becomes a chant, O mother and fatherland, show us a sign. Your children awaken to see. The morning will come when the world is mine. Tomorrow belongs, tomorrow belongs, tomorrow belongs to me. And these Nazi salutes go up all the way around. I know it's only a very well-crafted scene and a very well-made movie that won a host of Academy Awards in 1972, but it still sends a shiver down my spine in a way that nothing that Stephen King could ever do when I watched that scene. And the scary thing is really not about, primarily about anyway, about the rise of Nazism at that time, as horrific as that was. You can see that phenomenon portrayed in any number of films and documentaries in much more pointed ways than this scene does. What the makers of Cabaret did with this two-minute scene was to move beyond the film's historical context to a universal human reality. They demonstrated just how closely the angelic and the demonic can run together. They showed how quickly that which appears to be wholesome and virtuous can turn into an outright evil, even as the evil remains largely unseen. And that's what makes the scene so frightening. to see it only as a commentary on a certain segment of the German citizenry in the years leading up to World War II is really to miss that larger point and not quite get that larger message. But I'm going to stay with the scene for just a bit longer, nonetheless. The two film characters who had stopped for a drink, and one of them is an Englishman who is living in Berlin and giving English lessons, and the other is a rather aristocratic German politician, they are so repulsed at what they have seen that they get back in their car and they drive away. They both know and see what is going on. But the rest remain there, feeling as if they had just taken part in a very noble and uplifting moment. The people there at that tavern are, as they're portrayed in this scene anyway, good and virtuous people who feel, perhaps rightly so, that they and their country have been wrongly dealt with and demeaned after the First World War, especially by some of the more punishing provisions of the Treaty of Versailles. They felt they were seeking to reclaim their national pride and their national identity and their national dignity, which had been taken away from them. But those pastoral lyrics that initially evoked such pride and dignity and beauty, as we see, soon become words of defiance and hatred. Tomorrow belongs to me or to us and to nobody else, and nobody better get in our way. Well, I thought of this scene as I gathered my thoughts on the subject of virtue turning deadly. And yes, the scene I've been describing portrays an extreme example, but it makes a not-so-extreme point. If having a sense of pride and identity in one's nation and culture is a virtue, as I indeed happen to believe it is, it's a virtue which, under certain circumstances, can become very deadly. In fact, this is the case for many of the attributes that we call virtues. At some point, and under certain conditions, they can turn back on themselves. And this is the subject that I wish to address for a few minutes today. I found in recent weeks and months that I've been getting a fair amount of mileage from the writings of Forrest Church. I don't think he'll mind as long as you don't. He's been one of the ministers at the Unitarian Church of All Souls in New York City for the past 30 years. And in addition to being an outstanding preacher, he's a prolific writer. And I found a book of his that came out quite a few years ago now. It's called The Seven Deadly Virtues. I found that to be especially good. As you can probably guess, the title is a play on the seven deadly sins, to which I devoted a sermon series some time back. I'm not launching another such series on what Forrest is calling the seven deadly virtues. I'm just going to take it for this one Sunday, which will probably be just as well for all of us. What I especially appreciate about this particular work of Forrest is that it is a serious treatment, with some of his humor thrown in here and there, of the problem or issue of evil from a liberal religious standpoint. And we need such a treatment. But we religious liberals like to emphasize human goodness. We know that both our Unitarian and our Universalist movements began in part as a protest against the Calvinist doctrine of original sin. So we've got to be better than that. But taking a basically optimistic view of the human condition, as I think we rightly do, that still does not cancel out the reality of evil. And that's what Forrest is trying to get at in this book of his. And I'm going to read what I take to be the key line in it. Evil is not the privation or lack of good. It is the perversion of the good. That is why our virtues are so dangerous. Any given quality, if lifted above the scale of associated values and weighed independently, becomes an evil. Okay, his language gets a little weighty there. Let me see if I can break it down, what he's actually saying. For he's saying, and I agree with him, that a person runs the risk of practicing what Forrest is calling deadly virtue by taking one value or belief or moral principle and then making your fidelity to that so singular and so intense and so tunnel vision focused that you fail to see any other virtues, values, and moral principles that are also always at work. You set yourself up for deadly virtue, for this deadly virtue trap, when you get so focused on one value or one desired outcome that you lose sight, as I say, of any countervailing values or principles. Again, extreme examples abound. Most acts of terrorism are expressions of deadly virtue. I'd offer a slight twist on Forrest's definition of evil here. I'd say it is believing so strongly, that you are serving the right and the good, usually in accordance with what one believes to be the will of God, that you cannot see the evil element and the evil components of your deeds. Whether it's flying a plane load of passengers into a skyscraper, or bombing an abortion clinic, or blowing up a federal building, the perpetrators of these deeds are taking what they really and truly believe is fidelity to God or fidelity to their highest values, and elevating that fidelity above all other virtues and values, like, say, the value and the worth and the well-being of the lives of the innocent citizens with whose lives they are destroying. I think we've seen one of the more hideously perverse and sick examples of this kind of evil just this past week, following the death of actor Heath Ledger, the exact cause of which is still to be determined. No sooner was the word of his death out than some of the more radical elements of the Christian right, Fred Phelps's God Hates Fags outfit in particular, were hailing his death as retribution from God for Mr. Ledger's portrayal of a gay man in the movie Brokeback Mountain. How anyone can be so destructively deluded as to be a purveyor of this most disgusting kind of hatred in the name of a God of love is certainly well beyond my faculties to comprehend. And I will readily grant that a great majority of evangelical Christians in this country are as abhorred at these kinds of sentiments as I am. But I have to add, however, that as long as their belief, sincere as it is, in the inherent sinfulness of homosexuality remains a part of their overall belief system, as it largely does, then they're going to be stuck in this position of having to denounce the Fred Phelpses of this world on the one hand, while still clinging to a belief that demeans and robs the dignity of a certain segment of our population on the other. How long they can keep that kind of juggling act going or walking that tightrope is really for them to determine. It is time, however, for me and for us to move along. Perhaps the greatest irony and the most subtle snare of deadly virtue is that we are most susceptible and vulnerable to it when we are, in fact, dealing with something that is truly evil. This brings me to the example with which I opened today. I remain convinced that we as a nation, in concert with our allies, were dealing with a monstrous evil in the form of Nazism and in the person of Adolf Hitler, and that we were right to oppose it with military force. That's not to say I agree with every single one of our acts of war in the Second World War, but that's not a route I want to go right now. The point I'm making here is that even being on the side of virtue can make one vulnerable to deadly virtue. The late Kurt Vonnegut made a very wry and wise observation along this line about the unintended consequences of our being on the side of the right in the Second World War. And remember, Vonnegut fought in that conflict as a young infantryman, and he was a prisoner of war for a time at the hands of the Germans. This is his observation on the aftermath of the Second World War. It was, in one sense, very bad for us. Our enemies were so awful, so evil, that we, by contrast, must be remarkably pure. That illusion of purity, to which we were entitled in a way, became our curse. Strong words, but well said. For it was this illusion of purity, as Vonnegut calls it, that helped make possible the McCarthy era and the grievous excesses of the House Committee on Un-American Activities of that day. In defeating the evil of Nazism, we came to see ourselves as inviolate to the point that any criticism of America was an act of disloyalty, and those making that criticism were fair game for having their careers destroyed. It was this same illusion of purity, I believe, that unfortunately and tragically got us into Vietnam. And to this day, we have yet to completely come to terms with the now 30-year aftermath of that conflict. To take it a step further, I also believe it is this same illusion of purity that still has us, for all intents and purposes, pinned down in Iraq, surge or no surge. Again, we were the victims of a terrible evil when those planes hit the towers, guided as they were by the deadly virtue of those who commanded them. And now Vonnegut's words, I think, have come back to haunt us. Our enemies were so awful that we, by contrast, must have been remarkably pure. And this illusion of purity became our curse. We were so wrong, that is to say, that any response we chose to take, therefore, had to be right. Even if it meant invading and then becoming horribly enmeshed in a country that had virtually nothing to do with the evil that had been done to us. And we continue to pay the price to this day for this kind of deadly virtue. Augmented by the belief on the part of those who took us into it that they were somehow acting in accordance with the will of God. It's a price we continue to pay in American lives, in Iraqi lives, and in our standing in the world community. And I can understand now, as we're into this election season, I can see how the issue of the Iraq war may have dropped a few notches when it comes to some of the other issues that are on the hearts and minds of the American people. But it must not be allowed to drop out of sight in the months ahead, as we choose those who will lead us. Well, let me see now if I can get this subject down to where we all live before I'm done with it for the morning. If we are each and all susceptible, as I believe we are, to this deadly virtue, then how do we guard against it? Well, one way to avoid the snare of deadly virtue would be to avoid taking any kind of stance, any kind of position, any kind of action when it comes to one's moral and ethical principles. But that, too, would be deadly. It would constitute a defeatist and a resigned approach to life and living itself. So neither nihilism nor moral indifference are the proper antidotes to deadly virtue. I think we should take our stances firmly, and also with the use of our critical faculties, with an awareness of our human fallibilities, and always with an eye to the greater common human good, which all of our engagements with the larger world must in the end be serving. To pick up again on Dr. Church, he has a suggestion. I'm not sure if it's in this book or if I read it in some of his writings somewhere else. But he has something he calls the 60% principle. It goes like this. If you think you're at least 60% correct in your position or stance on an issue, then run with it. Or put your stick in the ground and stand by it. And however passionately you may act and advocate for your cause and your beliefs, keep that 60 or 70 or 80 or 90 or wherever you feel your percentage of correctness is on it, keep that somewhere tucked in the back of your mind. That way you leave yourself open and available for correction, should such prove to be needed. And as a corollary to this, don't forget to ask yourself the question on occasion, is my passion for this particular cause or issue, also in some way serving the greater human common good. On that note, I'm going to go one more round with Forrest as a way of moving towards a close for today. Quoting him again, "Whenever virtue squeezes out our fidelity to the common weal, the common good, we fall victim to idolatry. Apart from community, righteousness becomes self-righteousness." Just bear those last few words in mind. Apart from community, righteousness becomes self-righteousness. While we rightly praise those admirable individuals who take the courageous and sometimes lonely moral stance, more often than not, those same individuals had the wisdom to turn to a community of some nature where they could work out their stances within a community that they could trust and upon whose critical dialogue they relied. Martin Luther King, whose birthday we have celebrated this month, was a very courageous and often lonely individual. But he also remained throughout his life in very intense dialogue with his trusted and closest friends and associates, both African American and white, in honing his positions and in planning his actions. And he knew that in most cases, he would end up being the one out there standing. He would be the one end up being the lightning rod when it came to issues of racial justice and peace. And in the end, he often would retreat into his own thoughts and reflections and meditations and prayers before making his move. But he also relied throughout his life on his most trusted associates to keep a dialogue with him and to keep his righteousness from becoming self-righteous. And for that matter, even Jesus needed 12 associates, or communitarians, if you will, that he could trust and test out his ideas on. So the greatest piece of wisdom we can possess is knowing that we are each and all creatures of partial or limited wisdom. Such knowledge need not, and it must not, immobilize us. Rather, it should serve to keep us in authentic concert with the values and the virtues we strive to uphold. And this, indeed, is one of the many reasons why we exist in community here, so that we may have a place where we can come to engage in open and honest and respectful dialogues and conversations among ourselves when it comes to determining how we will live out the values we hold most dear. The Reverend Dick Gilbert says that one of the purposes of a liberal religious congregation is to bring people from the I of individualism to the we of community. And it is in such a community that our values are tested and reshaped and redefined. Finally, the best way to deal with the dynamic of virtue and deadly virtue is to remain always mindful of one of our more definitive liberal religious precepts, which is that there is and always will be more light to be revealed, more truth to be uncovered about the truths we hold dear. No canon of virtue is ever closed. While we finally do have to do what our hearts and our minds tell us is right, we must also keep our minds and hearts awakened and aware of new truths to be revealed.